hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting musician and composer Jan Tiersen to hear more about his latest studio album that revisits his back catalogue and offers new songs too.
Then we'll be discussing perspective with artist and Royal Academician Humphrey Ocean as his new monograph hits arty bookshops.
And while we're on the subject of art, we'll be hearing from Monocle's own culture editor Chiara Rimella, who's bringing us a special report from Art Basel in Miami Beach.
Thank you, Aug. That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We'll be looking ahead to next week's news, and we'll enjoy some fine music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Oh, wonderful spending a sort of Sunday at noon with you once again. How's your week been?
It never gets old, does it?
No.
I've had a lovely week. I've had a pre-Christmas social gear up week.
Okay, good.
I saw your eyes start shining there.
I just love Christmas. So.
It's great. It's the most wonderful time of the year. I went to see Fat White Family on Wednesday at Earth in London's Hackney.
Kaboom.
I can recommend that.
That's a fairly leery proposition for people that don't know the band Fat White Family. Renamed sometimes in an ironic way by Monocle members of staff, the Flat White Family. We tried to get them in for a session. If we rename them the Flat White Family, they might get played on the radio station.
Well, they were selling avocado on toast at the merch table.
Love that.
No, they weren't. For our listeners, their hits include Touch the Leather, which maybe gives you a sort of sense of what kind of thing they play. You and I had an enjoyable time, didn't we?
We did. We had a little Monocle Weekly out of studio experience. We went to see 1917, the new Sam Mendes film. And that is, I think it's one of the finest, most moving war films ever made. I mean, it's quite an extraordinary thing. We'll probably be reviewing it and talking about it on the Culture Show nearer the time. It comes out in the UK on January the 10th. I think it comes out very much around Christmas time in the US. Wherever you are in the world, it'll be coming to a cinema near you in a couple of weeks' time. Mm. But it's quite a stunning film, isn't it?
Yeah, I have to say, I was blindsided. I think it'll probably end up entering the canon alongside Saving Private Ryan. It felt like that good.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful thing. It's up there with Kubrick. It's up there with Lean. It's a really incredible piece of work.
Smashing.
But what are the major events around the world, or amusing events that aren't that major, but there's only one man that can put a wonderful spin on it.
Only one.
And that is this guy. There was something. Hello. Fernando, lovely to have you. Welcome to the programme. How are you this week?
I'm feeling very happy, actually, and quite excited for next week. Because I have to be honest, when I have to do the news look ahead, there a couple of weeks, I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to talk about? I usually go for a film release or something, but this week is a busy one. Huh?
Okay. It's quite a big week, isn't it?
It is a big week. And the first one, I think not many people might know. I mean, I know it is a bit nerdy from my part, but on Monday, my first story is the Human Development Index report will be released in Bogota. Yes, it's dry, all those reports. But the thing is, that's where I trust when I want to see the list of countries that are doing well, because this index doesn't only look at GDP per capita, but they look at education, they look about crime. So I really trust it. And I think and they tweak every year as well. So, for example, last year, their top 10 of the best countries, if I may say, it's Norway, Switzerland, Australia, Ireland, Germany, Iceland, Hong Kong, Sweden, Singapore, and the Netherlands. And that's where I see my country, Brazil, number 79. Ooh. Not very happy with it.
Yeah. Well, it's not. I mean, that's sort of just about, it's nearly the top half, isn't it?
I suppose so, yeah. I mean, how many countries are there? 152?
We're ahead of China and India, for example.
I suspect that Hong Kong might find its way out of that top 10 this year.
There'll be a bit of head scratching at HQ, I'd have thought, over that. Is that a United Nations thing or something? Who does that survey?
It is the United Nations. Mm. And so again, it's even more official numbers in a way. And I think every year they decide to go to a different city to release that. And this year, the Colombian president will be there for this release. And I'm very curious. I mean, Norway has been number one for quite a few years. And I wonder if, I don't know, Switzerland might be the year of Switzerland. So it's quite interesting. Oh, and just so you guys know, you're from the UK. Number 14, not bad.
Not bad. I can see that going south as well, depending on the outcome of one of our other stories, I suspect, knowing your penchant for
He loves an election.
He loves an election.
I do love an election. On Thursday, of course, it's elections in the UK. And my first question, I mean, we all know it's all complicated here in the UK this time. But what do you have like an election routine? Because, you know, I will stay awake the whole night. Usually I go to bed sometimes at 4 a.m. when they have the results. But I usually have a Haribo with me and some Coca-Cola as well, because I need to be awake.
Getting geared up for the election.
Do you have, or you just go, or you just sleep as normal?
It depends. In the last couple of elections, it's been a bit sad. So I haven't really, do you know what I mean? Actually the last one was the referendum and didn't go my way. The last election I kind of felt was a foregone conclusion, stupidly. I used to get really excited about it because it was a great piece of TV as well, when you weren't allowed to stay up all night, or when you were at school and, you know, you'd be allowed to stay up and stuff extra late to watch it. That was the thing. Nowadays, not so much. So, yeah.
And can I promo something here actually on air? Because as we're talking about, on Friday, of course, we'll be covering the election on The Briefing especially. And you know, I do my global countdown where I look at the top five singles. So this time I'm not revealing here, but I will do the top five, well, the songs that were number one in the last five general elections here in the UK.
That's a good one.
So I think sometimes it does reflect the mood of a country. Mm. You know, for example, I do suspect in 97 there was some very happy either Britpop or the Spice Girls at number one. But you have to listen to it to know.
Listener, watch this space.
That's a note. I like that. Like that a lot. I'll be tuning into that, Faye.
Just a little preview here. But guys, I saw you were talking about 1917, the new Sam Mendes film. So the Golden Globe nominations are coming out tomorrow. And can I defend the Golden Globes here?
Please.
I think they're fun. You know, actually the ratings, most award shows, the ratings have gone down. But the Golden Globes, they still remain, you know, quite healthy, because it's funny, you know, the artists, they are in tables with champagne, so they're usually probably a little bit more relaxed. And I think, you know, of course, they're not like the Oscars. The Oscars are the most important. But I think there's something special about the Golden Globes. And I like they divide between drama or comedy or or musical.
Yeah.
And they do for both, film and TV.
There's more genre and there's more kind of cracks of the whip. And you're right, it's nice to see people. I've kind of wondered why the Globes have obviously always have tended to have more interesting, you know, people up on stage. They've had, you know, Ricky Gervais did it, Like Him or Loathe Him. I mean, he certainly changed the way that was done. It's a little bit more knockabout and fun. And you kind of get criticised for not laughing rather than sitting there with your rictus grin on, waiting for the moment you can clutch a reward, right?
Exactly. And do you know the most interesting thing is that who votes for the Golden Globes is just this very small group of about 100 journalists, foreign journalists in LA.
Four old ladies.
Exactly.
Four old ladies in a beautiful house in Hollywood Hills.
Exactly.
The Golden Girls, basically.
Exactly, exactly.
I like that.
Yeah. I love it. Well, 1917, I think, of course, will be nominated.
I think you'll probably win quite a lot. Well, nice. Fernando, thank you so much for joining us to look through those fascinating stories as always. And I look forward to seeing you again next week, I hope. And obviously during the week as well, as my colleague.
Power to his election elbow.
Indeed. Don't eat too much Haribo. Listener, you're with the Monocle Weekly. In just a moment, we'll be hearing about the importance of analogue from Jan Tiersen.
French musician and composer Jan Tiersen became a household name for his work on the soundtrack of 2001's twee francophile classic Amélie. But as Augustine learned, that's hardly representative of his striking oeuvre.
Since the mid-90s, Tiersen has been pushing the boundaries of instrumentation with his haunting progressive compositions. Many of his albums have been recorded at his home on the island of Ushant off the coast of Brittany and sit nearer the work of some of the world's great avant-garde and experimental composers than whimsical French films.
Tiersen has recently released a new album, Portrait, revisiting songs from his back catalogue, recorded on analogue and featuring guest spots from the likes of Sons, Stephen O'Malley and Gruff Rhys and Blonde Redhead. And it's a far cry from the gentility of Amélie. Org sat down with him to find out more.
Anyway, I can try anything. It's the same circle that leads to nowhere. I'm tired now anyway. I've lost my face, my dignity, looks, everything is gone. And I'm tired now.
The idea of the record started when we been rehearsing the last tour after my album All was out. We were four on stage, Olavo Jacobsen, Jens Thompson, Emily, my wife, and me. And it's just like really kind of stripped down versions. And really early, I had the feeling that we went straight to the point to reach kind of the essence of the songs. And that would be like so good to record that. And we were rehearsing in my studio, which is also a venue. And I thought, okay, let's just book a period in next summer where we can like record and let's do it analog because we can record lots of it live. And I got those tape machines. And yeah, that was the impulse.
So it's not the first album that you, because you built this studio, which is an analog recording studio.
Yeah, well, digital as well, but
digital
yeah,
as well.
It's like yeah, with vintage gears, and I got those beautiful tape machines, so I can go back to analog if yeah. I want to, and I want to because I think it's such a. There is the sound, you know. I think it's not a matter to be better or not that. It's just like analog, stay in the real world. Because even if you get like a high definition samples or high definition pixels for photography, it's still like numbers, zero and one. And it's in the virtual world. And it's not the same. I don't know. There is something organic, and it's good to stay in reality. I like the process, the way you work when you stay analog as well, because you have to choose everything, because everything matters, and that creates maybe more tension, but in a good way. And you're involved in every single step of the recording, of the mixing, of everything. And you have to choose. And I think this makes good records.
In the face of this kind of infinite options of digital, confines do lead to more successful sort of creative endeavours often. I mean, is that something that you found elsewhere in your music writing?
I think limitation is always yeah. something good. With Gareth, like, it's something else, but we were talking about, like, for instance, like, you know, we used to edit the vocals and we were thinking, oh, how did they do like in the past? And the answer was just like, you know, for the mouse noises and kind of stuff. Now you just like skip them and you just take your virtual scissors. And the answer is like the singer just like were trying not to have mouth noises and sing better, which is, yeah, okay. That's the analog way to solve the problem, which is the best way for sure. The studio for sure changed. Because the acoustic is of this studio is magical, and it's a bit by chance because we did it with the architect. But we were thinking, okay, later we will change the acoustic with treatment and everything. But it was perfect already, like really, like reverby, but not too much. And it's an old disco, so it's full of good vibrations. And the island, the I don't know how it affects the music, but I know that, like, for instance, like with collaboration or Stephen O'Malley coming in the studio to play guitars, like the good thing about this studio is like when you invite people, first, if you stay in analog, you need to have them in the studio. And then coming on the island is already something, and you have like Gruff or Stephen were there, and then you share something else that recording, because then you're living all together kind of like for 1-2 days or whatever. And so it's an experience, and it's like it's good. And it's changing the music.
You mentioned Stephen O'Malley. The tracks that he's on are among my favorite on the album, and particularly Prad.
Oh, me too.
The sound of his guitar made me think very much of a ship's horn kind of blaring away across the English Channel. That seemed to me, maybe it's a bit too literal, but that seemed quite a direct reflection of this kind of being on the sea, I suppose.
That's crazy because when I did this piano track for Ohm, for the album before, I just like had heavy guitars in mind, and I'm a huge fan of synth, so I was basically thinking about the sound. Mm. But then I tried on this one, and it wasn't really convincing. So I just left it, and the track was like this. And 1 year after, of course, I asked Steven to, can you give it a try? And then it was perfect, and it was so, a will, a dream come true. Mm. So it was really good.
I wanted to talk to you about the way your relationship with these songs has changed as you re-recorded them for Portrait. I know that La Dispute, which is the song that features heavily on the Amélie soundtrack, underwent a change for you after that film was released, and that maybe that you began to feel quite distant from it in how you had intended it to be heard and how it was then interpreted against the backdrop of this very colourful kind of fantastical film about Paris. How has revisiting it and playing it again, has that restored your relationship with the song?
I'm coming from, I just start using acoustic instruments because of samplers. And my musical background, I mean, the music that inspired me to start making my own music is more like industrial music and bands like Throbbing Gristle or Eichthusen and Neuenbauten. And that's my, musical environment. And then doing acoustic things and gentle accordion or stuff was kind of not a reaction to that, but part of it. It was like sampling. I started first to sample those kind of instruments because they were really far away from my background and culture and what I was listening to. And it was weird. And my music with this part of it, this weird connection and this weirdness and playing in festivals. Like I did, I remember the festival in Brittany where there was like Faust playing and Charlemagne Palestine and me. And that was the right context. And suddenly with the movie, it was really successful, which was like, I'm not a mainstream. I don't know. I wasn't like, I never planned to do commercial music. It was really successful. And it was like all those distances and this weirdness with my music was suddenly gone, and it was like first degree, accordion linked to Montmartre and to Parisian folklore. That's completely, there is something really fucked up about that.
Yeah, big time. What was it like, apart from Stephen O'Malley, you worked with Blonde Redhead on this album, and of course all the people that you mentioned from the live show. How easy do you find the process of collaboration, and how enjoyable?
For Stephen O'Malley, it was like something magical. And the same with Blonde Redhead is the exception to the rules, like for this album, because they couldn't make it for the studio. But they were so... I had this song, the lyrics and melody, and I wanted two vocalists, And my wife, they just thought about them, and I'm really fan of them. Like from the beginning, I said, "Oh yes, of course, that's the perfect match." And they were so nice. Like Kazu was in Italy, where she lived on an island as well, which is, and Amadeus lives in New York, and they just like recorded the track like, I don't know, in days, like really quickly, and it was like really good. They were really nice to work with. So even if they weren't there, it was like a big time collaboration. Graf Rees, he came to the island, and this is so important to me as well, because Monochrome was a song that I wrote a long time ago, but in English, and I always wanted to be sung by an English speaker. And in that case, it was a Welsh speaker, which was like so good. And so it was making so that much sense. And it was like so good to have him on the island and chatting, talking together about like lots of things and the place of languages as well. So to answer the question, like, collaboration is always like, I touching wood, it's always a miracle, and it's always good. I never had till now a bad experience.
My thanks to Jan Tiersen, and Portrait is out now. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. It's time for some music. In just a sec, Rob, we'll be hearing from painter Humphrey Ocean, who is great friends with none other than Ian Jury.
How was he?
Of Ian Jury and the Blockheads.
Brilliant.
With whom my father once had a pint.
Okay,
in
good.
A pub in Sloane Square.
Was it the antelope?
Can't answer. I'll text him. to get us warmed up, let's hear a track from the man himself. This, from his great album, New Boots and Panties, is Wake Up and Make Love With Me.
Wake Up and Make Love With Me by Ian Jury. That is one of my favourite songs. Ian Jury can do little wrong. And you are listening to The Monocle Weekly. Next up, it's Humphrey Ocean.
London's Royal Academy remains one of the more august art institutions in the UK. Humphrey Ocean is one of the more august painters. It's only right that the two should be connected, and indeed they are. Ocean is the Royal Academy Professor of Perspective, walking in the footsteps of the likes of Turner.
Ocean's work finds inspiration in observation, from his seminal portrait of Philip Larkin to his 70s work that looks today almost like history painting. He's unquestionably a master, one, however, who has not stood still. Across his five-decade career, he's continued to push himself, how he sees and how he responds in paint.
Now, his life's work has been collected in a new monograph, bringing together work from all stages of his career. It offers an extraordinary insight into one of the country's great painters. I spoke to Humphrey earlier and began by asking what it's like having one's life's work collected in one place.
Well, as we used to say in the old days, all I want for my birthday is another birthday. For me, it's remarkable getting this far, but it's a halfway point. We'll do another 50 years in 50 years' time, I hope, if medical science can keep up with me.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely an agenda there, being prosecuted by people in Silicon Valley to extend it indefinitely. If it were to keep going for another 50 years, how do you think it would change?
I have absolutely no idea what's going to happen tomorrow, so goodness knows what's going to happen.
But you won't be doing any of the kind of Hockney iPad paintings.
Good point. I sort of think I use paint because it's about 17,000 years ahead of the curve. You know, we've all got screens and computers. I mean, I've had screens ever since I was born because I was, you know, being driven around in a Morris 8 and what have you. So I've seen the world, you know, through, kind of mediated in that way, slightly at a distance. But paint is, you know, it's mud, it's earth and pigment and clay and excrement and what have you. It's a sort of fluid thing. It's part of us. It's what we stand on. And I just think that the caves at Lascaux, which were done 17,000 years ago, I know that's relatively recent. You know, they found hand drawings from 100,000 years ago now. But art doesn't get, it's not like science. It doesn't improve. It's not linear. It's circular. So I am kind of doing exactly what they did 17,000 years ago. And computer screens are in their infancy. They also make everything glossy and beautiful, fabulous. You know, you look at things on a screen, wow. Sometimes you don't want wow. Sometimes you want drab, dreary, and what have you. And if you want dreary, I'm your man.
You mentioned that love of cars there, and your painting that's from 1982, Lord Volvo and His Estate. Maybe some of our listeners will kind of immediately think of that painting when they think of you. And it has this car at the centre, but what I gleaned reading the accompanying text was that in the background you've used some of the buildings from around Peckham Rye, which is a part that I know very well. And when I saw that, it sort of became instantly recognisable, even in the topography of it somehow. And I wondered how, you know, this is almost a history painting now. It has these kind of men who are dressed like skinheads standing around an outdated car. But the place is still very familiar. I wondered how your relationship to places, to London, to the areas that you've painted over the years, how they've changed, or whether it kind of hasn't.
Very good question. I live near Peckham. I've lived in central Peckham for the first 10 years. I now live a little bit further out beyond Peckham Rye, sort of for the next 30. And when I went there in 1979, you know, they said you'd be mugged in a week and murdered in a fortnight. Actually, it was the most parochial place that I've ever lived. Why did I move there? Because, you know, artists need space. And at that time, you know, you could get more room. And actually, although Peckham is seriously trendy now, if you walk down Rye Lane, it still looks pretty much as it did when I first went there. I used to have this idea that, you know, eventually I'll live in Malibu. And then I thought, well, you know, who would I ring up? You know, where could I get a curry? Well, I've been told, you know, you can get anything in Malibu now. But I'd just be in the wrong place. And I've had to try and make the best of where I've landed economically, which is, I think, it turns out that's the way that the world works.
There's something quite nice about that, you know, as you describe the pace of change that happens. I mean, it's happening in Peckham, but it happens around London, this kind of process of gentrification that nonetheless does leave areas still quite recognisable. And I suppose it's something that I was kind of reflecting on, you know, in this painting you have this kind of group of young people dressed in a style that is almost kind of in again, but still anachronistic, in a place that is recognisably the same. It spoke to something quite satisfying in its relationship to time, I think, or its perspective indeed on time.
When I was doing that painting, it was the result of a day out down in Sussex. Actually, we went to the Museum of Curiosity down in Arundel, and we ended up looking out over the Devil's Dyke in Brighton. And I just wanted to make a picture to mark the occasion. You know, that was the first inkling of an idea. And then it was kind of too far away, and all the people who were in the painting were people I knew, local. And I was painting the car, just to say the car was 10, 15 years out of date when I painted it, but it was my car. The people were wearing what is currently worn. I mean, it may now look like they're wearing, you know, like it's like looking at a sort of Rembrandt. I mean, I'm not comparing myself to Rembrandt, but just, you know, the clothes may look as old-fashioned clothes do look, slightly out of date, that sort of thing. I was painting the car on Peckham Rye, and those are the buildings in the background. And, of course, I start thinking about the buildings, and I thought, well, those blocks of flats are designed to look like houses, so that if you're coming home at the end of the day, you know, with your briefcase or what have you, and you think, oh, I'm going home, and they had roofs and chimneys and that sort of thing. And anyway, it just seemed to be, it was the beginning of making something local, which I understood. I didn't necessarily like it, but it was just familiar, and that sort of thing. The title came at the very, very end. I mean, I worked on the painting for a year and three quarters, just about. And then my friend Ian Dury just had a look at it and he said, Lord Volvo and his estate. You know, in a second. Horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, but good.
That's really good, isn't it? That process, that year and a half, that 18 months of working on the painting and the numerous preparatory sketches, a lot of which featured in this book, in an essay here, it sort of indicates that actually you've moved away from that a bit, that now you're kind of as interested in painting something quickly in the sketch versus something that's kind of laboured over. And I wondered what your reflections were on that. Is it an immediacy that you kind of find satisfaction in, that you can only get through a sketch, that's lost when you're kind of painstakingly preparing for a painting?
Yes, I worked it. The realisation wasn't immediate. It took probably, you know, 20 or 30 years. But I can remember somebody looking at that painting, Lord Volvo and His Estate, and the dog. And I'd done a painting of Sammy, the dog, from life. And it was, I now recognise, so full of truths and real colour and what have you. It might have been a bit wonky, but there was something about it. And then I, you know, did the painting and worked on it and drew it all out carefully. And it took me a long time to realise that the things that I was doing immediately had an immediacy. Mm-hmm. And that they became my kind of guide for when I was then working on, when everyone had gone away and I was just left in the studio and spending, you know, weeks or something on a picture. This thing that I'd done in a moment contained almost everything that I needed. And then I kind of realised that I would cut out the end man, as it were, and hang on to those. And I love meeting people and making absurd assumptions about them, as it were. And that's when I now paint the series that I've been working on now for about 10 years, which I call A Handbook of Modern Life. It's like me meeting you, but just extended. It's sort of like a click of the camera, but the exposure is sort of 45 minutes to an hour. But it's that quick, and there's that much. There's I don't, you know, one doesn't know what goes into a painting. I mean, they are a record of me being, you know, if I was painting you, of that hour that I spent with you. No, it's not for me to reason why, how, what have you, you know, whether it's any good, whether it's a likeness or that. But it will be like you, as it were. Can't help it. But it'll also be a bit like me.
There's something in that. It's funny that you mentioned Rembrandt a moment ago. I always think of his... I much prefer his drawings to his paintings, you know, and the kind of that similar sense of a place alive, of someone experiencing it in the moment and that quality being preserved in the drawing. I wanted to go back to Ian Dury because that's fantastic, a connection to have a relationship with him, but also to have had this painting titled. I was surprised to read there that he... you know, while teaching you art, was quite determined that you should really study the figure that you were painting and that that's something you've kind of carried on throughout your career. Indeed, you were hooked up to an MRI scanning machine to see how you looked when you were observing someone or something that you were drawing. How surprising were the results of that scan, of these scientific tests to track your eyes against the subject?
Oh, well, the scan was... When I did the only life drawing that I ever did, which was with Ian, that was 1971. The scan was 1998, not with Ian, with John Chalenko, who's a filmmaker, who was kind of trying to study how artists thought. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, you won't get that from me. You'll get how I think, you know, not how... There's not a sort of generic thing. But it, funnily enough, it proved one of the things that Ian had taught me, which is, when you're drawing somebody, you're drawing what you see and you have to kind of forget what it is that you're drawing and you'll look harder. Because if you try and draw a nose, it will look like a sort of comic book nose. But if you put the shapes that are there in front of you, half an hour of that, and you look away and say, hey, presto, there's a nose. It's the same thing when you... What they discovered was that a part of the brain that one uses when one is drawing is the same part when one is manoeuvring around tables and chairs. It's a spatial thing. But when I meet you again, I will say, hi, you know, I'll recognise you, and that will be a different part of the brain. Although, I'd be drawing a face, when I'm drawing it, it's something different. So it's now, as it were, has been proved by controlled experiment. But the drawing that I originally did with Ian, actually, that was the thing that changed my life entirely. Because I started drawing things in places that I just didn't even know there were places. And really, just as a sort of shorthand, you know, it made me look at things like chicken wire differently. And I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, somebody's had to design that and think about it. And I'd look at it that much more closely. So it kind of increased my wonder of the world. You know, the world is full of absolute precisions, and I don't understand most of them. But, you know, I kind of enjoy looking at quite a lot of them.
So was it something that you knew you did when you painted all of it? I was wondering how unconscious the kind of the deep looking, as it were, was before you were subjected to scientific tests, and how much you knew that you were doing it and that it was just validation of that. And I suppose whether in turn that informed how you made paintings, how you made drawings moving on with that kind of the certainty of that knowledge.
One of the things, because I paint things, you know, I was kind of brought up with people. I mean, I went to art school. Most of the people were doing abstract paintings. But I wanted to say, hey, I've seen this, you know, much as like when you hear a bit of music that you like, you know, you want to kind of tell somebody about it and see if they like it. That's part of it, you know, and that is not just any old piece, that piece of music. Do you like it, you know? And if they do, then they can be in your gang, as it were. It's like that. Looking at stuff is just what I do, and I respond to it, you know. It's quite difficult looking at people in England because it's the beginning of a fight, you know. Who are you looking at? That sort of thing. You go to somewhere like Brazil, people sit on a bus and for half an hour will just stare at each other and may even fall in and out of love, you know, that sort of thing. But it's... I'm saying that because I've been to Brazil, you know, and it's very good for an Englishman's spine, you know, because you relax. And it's legitimate. I mean, one of the things when I'm making a portrait is that I'm allowed to stare at you and see what it is that makes up what I'm looking at. So there is, in a curious way, no difference between your hair and your eye when I'm looking at, because it's drawable and it has a shape. And even, you know, I suppose when people draw sort of things a bit vaguely, I begin to lose interest. And I think, well, they're not very interested in. One of the things I learned at art school was you have to love what you do. And if you don't, you've got to make yourself love it. And then you'll do it that much better. It'll also be that much more enjoyable.
Thanks to Humphrey Ocean, and his monograph, published by the Royal Academy, is out now. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly. Today it's grim and grisly here in Europe, but not so in Florida. Perhaps that's why so many of the art world's great and good have decamped to the Sunshine State this week.
Yeah, that and Art Basel in Miami, Rob. I know you're going to laugh at me for how
well.
I say it.
I know it well, Org. I got married at Art Basel 5 years ago.
Did you?
Yeah, in Miami.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Did you get a special...
Miami Beach District Courthouse.
A special ring by David Shrigley.
Sadly not.
Ah, more's the pity.
Just one of the huge.
Well, congratulations.
It's a weirdly fun honeymoon going to all the parties in Miami.
I wonder if our culture editor, Chiara Ramella, will come back similarly hitched. She's been there seeing what all the fuss is about, and she brings us this report.
The beginning of December signals the last hurrah in the year's art market calendar, Art Basel, Miami Beach. Collectors from all around the world at the camp to Florida for a sun-soaked week that's always filled with meeting, greeting, networking, and so, so much partying. But at heart, this fair remains a very important commercial exercise. The American market seems energetic, and the gallerists know it, which is why they often choose to tailor their booth's offering to the regional buyer's scene. Alex Longsdale, executive director of London's Lisson Gallery, tells us more about the considerations that went into the gallery's selection of works.
We show several Latin American artists, and we show them all around the world. But yes, there's always a certain level of choice around the kind of works you bring to a specific fair or that you show in a specific show in any city in the world, because you have to engage the local audience. And the audience here is, there's a big expat community of Brazilians, Argentinians, Colombians, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a big Latin community in Miami, and they are very engaged. So it's wonderful to be able to engage them.
The right choice of works to present in Miami needs to take into consideration not only artists that can relate to the local community, but also the topics that are increasingly discussed in the art world and beyond. Challenging a white, male-dominated narrative has clearly been a focus for institutions and fairs in recent times. Longsdale introduces us to one of his booth's highlights.
So these are new works by Hugh Hayden, who's a young artist from Dallas that lives in New York, who we've been working with for just over about a year and a half. Typically, he works in wood. These are the first wood works he's made that are cast. They're skillets, like cast iron skillets that have casts of traditional West African masks on them. And this relates deeply to the tradition of Southern cooking and the influence of West African food on Southern food, which is something that I don't know that is, outside of the South, is not super well known. But there's this rich history of trade between the two originating during the slave trade. So this is like a way of incorporating the two cultures in an aesthetic capacity.
Do you find that the kind of conversations that you've been having with collectors have evolved over the last few years to encompass different kind of topics? Are they more or less concerned with certain kinds of topics?
It's always evolving. The things people care about change constantly. And that applies to art, and that applies to politics and culture. And if everything was static, it would be extremely boring.
Of course, but by which I meant to ask, and what kinds of conversations have you been having recently that perhaps have struck you as recurring?
I think we're living in very strange times, and people respond to work that addresses the strangeness of our times. It's a very hard moment to make sense of, and people are trying to make sense of it through politics, but also through culture.
Grabbing the attention of collectors is fundamental for gallerists, but collectors themselves know that, in order not to feel overwhelmed by the amount of work in these halls, they have to come to the convention center with a plan. Other than being the founder of Brazilian art fair SP Arte, Fernanda Feitosa is a prominent collector herself. She shares with us her method to tackle this beast of an art fair and reveals there is a lot of intuition and creativity at play when it comes to building your own collection.
You have to have a strategy. I don't think you could come here without a strategy in your head. Otherwise, you get lost in the corridors with so many beautiful things and attracting things to look at. And then you miss what you perhaps should be looking at. When I come here, I try to make a plan. First, to visit all the Brazilian galleries, because I'm Brazilian, so I try to visit all the Brazilian galleries and the foreign galleries who represent our Brazilian artists. I try to see how they are being placed, with whom they are being placed with, which artist, next to each artist they are being placed with, because I think it's very interesting information that you could add to your head when you're building your own collection, which artist dialogue better with each one. And then I try to go to the foreign galleries, mostly who dealing with Latin American artists, because that's my personal interest, Brazilian artists and their dialogues with the Latin American region. And that will go from one place to another, also visiting European galleries and American galleries to see what their connections are with the Brazil. I'm mostly interested with the connections with Brazil.
Oh, it's very interesting to have a specific focus. I also wonder, do considerations of media, for example, interest you? Do you go to the fair thinking, I would like more installations, I would like more painting. Is that a consideration, or do you just let yourself kind of be taken by what you see?
I think I'm taken by what I see. We collect everything, all the medias. Of course, we have more paintings, photography, and sculptures, less performing arts or videos. We found it a little bit more difficult to find the pieces that we are interested in. But no, I think for medias, I don't have a specific strategy. If I found papers, if I found photographs or paintings that I'm drawn to, then it's a must go. It's a must have.
What about budget? Do you come out here with a certain budget in your head and you know that's what you will spend, or does it depend from fair to fair?
It depends from fair to fair. I don't have a budget. We have over 1,000 pieces at home. In photograph, for instance, we have over $1 million in works, in artworks. But it's when we see a piece and it's important for the collection as a whole, when it completes a hole that we have in the collection, then we buy it regardless of the price. Of course, if it's in the correct price, because as collectors, we tend to know the price, the correct and reasonable price of an artwork that we know. Of artists that we know.
For those collectors that like to take their time over the works on show, this year, Art Basel Miami Beach is launching a new section called Meridians. Entirely dedicated to large-scale works, this section provides a completely different experience to the mayhem of the main fair hall below. It's also an occasion for this fair to reflect on its geopolitical context and for the organic links between Miami and Latin America to come to the fore.
Well, we're really hoping that this is going to be a section that is going to give like a new texture to the whole show, in the sense that it's really opening a space for works that didn't fit in the traditional art fair booth just because of the size. So it's called Meridians. So of course that's a reference to that imaginary line that links, you know, like the two poles of the planet. So like north and south and south and north, you know, like both ways, of course. So it's really, you know, like about expanding, let's say, the reach of, you know, like the art fair, both in terms of geography and in terms of the scale of the works. So I think this really meant for me, you know, like a way to rethink also about the notion of scale in terms of, you know, like how the works can be expanded both in time and space. So there is not only quite a few historical works, but also like much more contemporary ones that were produced specifically for the fair. There's performance, which is also like very difficult to present in a traditional environment, and video installations, all sorts of different things.
People who've been going to Art Basel in Basel for a few years will be familiar with the section that's unlimited, that's also dedicated to great scale works. How does this compare to that? Did you approach it as the Miami equivalent, or did you think of it in a separate way?
No, I think we thought about it in a separate way. You know, like it's, of course, you know, like it's a very similar section and, you know, like it's totally comparable just because of the same principle of showing like large scale works. But at the same time, I think just because, you know, like of a natural situation that we are located in the Americas, there is like a very strong link between Miami and, you know, like the south of the continent, it's probably easier for some of the galleries, you know, like to apply and present works in this context than in Unlimited. Talking in very practical terms, you know, like thinking about shipments, all of that becomes for everyone, you know, like probably easier for some of the galleries to present large-scale works here than in Basel. So like very naturally and very organically, we have maybe like a stronger representation of projects from the Americas in Miami than there usually is in Art Basel.
It's also interesting because obviously the works are large-scale, but there is quite a large amount of painting in this hall as well. And I think that's quite remarkable because we don't necessarily, I think people, when they think about large scale works, they tend to think of kind of colossal installations. Why put so many paintings in these halls? And is it also always in the background an ambition to maintain a certain level of kind of commercial feasibility for these works as well, and not just the museum-like presentation?
This is the first iteration of the show, as you know, and so maybe you know how the process works. It's basically like an invitation to the participating galleries in the main show to present, you know, like one specific large-scale project. So it's really, you know, like we're working with a pool of proposals that come directly from the gallery. So then, based on like different different criteria. We selected the works, like the committee, I present the works and then the committee selects the works. So it's really more, you know, like about this sort of conjunction of opportunities. And it's true in this edition, we had like a big amount of pictorial works. But then I guess it's going to be like shifting, you know, like every year probably. But at the same time, even though there's like quite a few, you know, like painting proposals, I think they vary very much also in the kind of discourses they have. There is a fantastic, really incredible Mario Mertz painting, which is of course a painting, but I think, you know, like his work can be approached in very different manners. There is a 20 meter long painting by Flavio, or like a painting project by Flavio Garzandia, in which he invites like more than 150 Cuban artists to paint one stripe of color. So it's, of course, the result of that is a like large-scale painting again, but really it's more, I would say, like of a conceptual gesture, even though he's a painter, but really in which you can, you know, like really create a collectivity, you know? And of course that takes like different meanings in terms of politics and, you know, like just cultural policy when thinking also about, you know, like a country like Cuba, who is like very difficult situation with regards to the United States.
For all the commercial goings-on, Art Basel Miami Beach also brings plenty of public art to the city. This, like the activity inside the halls, often ends up being temporary, but it is no less impactful because of this. Argentinian artist Leandro Ehrlich has worked on a colossal installation on the sand of Miami Beach, representing a huge, partly sinking traffic jam. Curated by Jimena Caminos in collaboration with Brandy Reddick, this is the first time the city of Miami Beach has commissioned a temporary installation. The fact it will soon disappear will probably make it resonate even more with the public that comes to see it.
I think there is a poetry in the temporary. Sometimes I think that we forget that we are temporary as well. We have an issue dealing with our finitude, I don't know how to say it. I think that our eagerness for transcendence always aims for building in permanent way and building things to last beyond our own life, and which is admirable in this effort. And maybe a psychologist can address this to the idea of transcendent death or whatever. But the poetry on something that is ephemeral and fragile, to me, is something that brings us to reflect upon our own fragility and our own time. You mentioned the idea of time, which for me is crucial. Our own time on the planet, individual, as well as our own time in the planet as a species. And, you know, on another level, on a traffic jam, which is the narrative of the work itself, there is also a sense of time. Because once we are on a traffic jam, our mind goes into, you know, the idea of wasting time, or suddenly something is attacking our efficiency, because we are usually commuting, we're going somewhere, or we're coming from somewhere. And a traffic jam is kind of an error in our system. We try to avoid, we try to get around that error. We, you know, and hopefully I don't get the traffic jam. Or maybe I go 1 hour before, or I come back 2 hours later to avoid the traffic jam. And we get around the problem without acknowledging that there is a problem. And as we all know by now, we're not that young. The first step to find a solution for a problem is to acknowledge it.
Once the carousel of the art world has left and the traffic jams on Miami's streets have dispersed, it's pieces like this that will linger in the memory. From Monocle in Miami Beach, I am Chiara Romella.
Thanks to Chiara. You, listener, are with the Monocle Weekly, just about.
Thanks for giving us that reminder of what we're listening to, Org. Actually, it's time for us to check out. That was edition 544 of the Monocle Weekly. I enjoyed it greatly.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I enjoyed putting it together, actually. It was a nice mixture, as our executive producer Tom Edwards would say, light and shade, light and shade.
Light and shade.
One of his many buzzwords.
Talk like a sort of like naff 70s football manager.
Yeah, a little bit.
Light and shade, boys. Light and shade, back of the net. Okay.
I particularly encourage you to pick up my copy of Humphrey Ocean's monograph, which is sitting on my desk. Great painting.
I love Humphrey Ocean. He gave me a tour of the Royal Academy a few years ago.
I bet that was a laugh.
He's a proper grown up. Yeah, he's nice, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's quite well. He's quite a natty dresser, isn't he? What was he? Was he?
He looked
sharp. I missed that interview, obviously, when he came in here that day. But he's quite sharp, isn't he?
He's very sharp. He looked at me extremely intensely.
Did he?
Which I guess is his prerogative.
That's his perspective
as a portraitist.
Yeah. Okay.
Still unsettling though.
Is it? Was he just staring into the dark depths of your geared-up soul?
Yeah, indeed he was.
I think it's time for us to thank our friends behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Augustine Macellari, and our studio manager was the great Maylie Evans.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Augustine Macellari.
And it's goodbye from me, Robert Pound.
Bye.
Bye.